Let's go now to New Bedford, where Herman Melville set Moby Dick and where Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery dressed as a mariner. Today, it has the most valuable commercial fishing port in the world. But for years now, it has also had a shrinking newspaper of record, the Standard Times. The paper once had almost 60 full-time staff, but has fewer than 15 today, according to the Boston Business Journal. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp bought the paper in 2007, and since it has changed hands between large media conglomerates several times. Stephen Taylor, a former Boston Globe executive, teamed up with a group of other local investors to try to save it.
The fundamental premise of a substantial fourth estate in New Bedford was shrinking drastically, and our founders and we want to see if we can do something about bringing that back.
Taylor and friends tried to buy the Standard Times back from its current owner, Gannett. When they were turned down, they started over, founding a new nonprofit newsroom, the New Bedford Light. We caught up with Taylor recently and with Barbara Rossner, the Light's editor, about this new venture. And Bobby began by telling us what makes New Bedford so special.
New Bedford is a particularly interesting place. It's rich history as the capital of the whaling industry and then of the textile industry. It's where Herman Melville set Moby Dick. It's where Frederick Douglass escaped as a slave, came to New Bedford, learned to preach here, first registered to vote here. I mean, it's just got this incredible history and then waves and waves of immigration, which continue now. And I think it's just a fascinating place. I mean, every place I've ever worked has been fascinating, but New Bedford has some elements that are particularly fertile for the kind of coverage that we are attempting to provide. The in-depth investigative type story, and really important to us, is the arts and culture coverage, which is our way of getting into all the many, many pockets of New Bedford's diverse culture.
So, Steve, tell me a little more about these particular types of stories, subject areas that are ripe for your coverage in New Bedford, and maybe one that you feel hasn't been covered enough.
Oh, I think the list is long, and the editors would know, too. I came to know New Bedford and Buzzards Bay and this area by water. I know it very, very well, in fact, by water. And so issues of the cleanup of Buzzards Bay and the environment, one of our founders was a former mayor who had a lot to do with getting that cleanup done. The environmental issues that are going to have to be confronted, like any waterfront city, with sea level rise and climate change, but also part of the solution is going to be an offshore wind. And you may know there's a delicate dance between the offshore wind necessity and the fishing industry, which is a critical, biggest part of New Bedford's past and substantial part of its future. And so covering all of those various angles as they unfold is going to be really important. And that doesn't even begin to get to the political and educational and cultural social services scene. So we're starting with the cultural, as Bobby just described, and some deep explanatory and investigative and data-driven stories about things in New Bedford that people wouldn't know about without us.
Bobby, is there an example of a story in maybe the recent history of New Bedford? You can go back a little further if you want to. Story of wrongdoing or accountability that would not have been exposed without robust local news. Sort of bring home why this fourth estate presence is so important.
Well, rather than the investigative area or malfeasance, it's really more basic than that. We were getting off the ground and thinking about this and what our mission is and what our vision is as COVID was ravaging the city. And I did not see a lot of coverage of COVID. I didn't know what was going on, how many people had died, for example. And one of the first things we did, and it took us a couple of months to get the data, was to find out who died in New Bedford from COVID. And it was more than 400 people. And we went and we talked to those people. And it was amazing, the stories that came through. And when we analyzed the data, we found an occupational cluster, that there was a cluster of retired textile industry workers who appeared to have been particularly vulnerable to COVID because of long-time respiratory issues that were related to their work. I mean, the city didn't know where it was in terms of COVID. And that was just a basic thing that we wanted to bring to the table to say, okay, this is what's happened in this past year and a half. And it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had the resources and the commitment and the support, incredible support we have from the community, to really dig into that and get the data and then mine that data for the storytelling that I think will really be part of the city's history.
Steve, with that kind of urgency in mind, let's talk a little bit about resources and how this works. It's nonprofit, but that doesn't mean it doesn't need revenue. Of course it does. You're not selling ads. It's free. How to stay financially viable in the long run, and any concern about that you relying on sources that you then have to report on?
Well, I think the answer to the latter case is no, because I think the sophisticated people who want to sponsor us realize that straightforward, hard-hitting coverage comes with the territory, whether they're involved or not. And we would have to just not take funds from somebody who felt otherwise. But there's a significant amount of foundation money out in the country, some of whom have mission statements that are pretty much on the center line of what we're trying to do. There's a very substantial number of people in New Bedford and in the immediately surrounding communities who care very deeply about this project, some of whom have real capacity, and we've already benefited from some great generosity. But we had 287 gifts and counting from people for as little as $5 or $10 or $25 or $7.50 a month. And it was really great to see. Bobby's team has only been publishing we're not even at the end of our sixth week yet. But every time something new comes out, we get a burst of gifts, electronic gifts. And one of my biggest problems as the kind of 1.5-person business office right now is keeping up with the thank you letters. That's a really good problem to have. But we're automating some of that.
It does sound like a good problem to have. It does make me want to just push one more time, Bobby, on the editorial wall. I mean, you've got, and maybe the answer is this is no different than people buying a paper, right? They're giving you money for stories in your paper, or they're making contributions. But there does seem to be a sort of causality here that Steve's talking about. Are you satisfied that you've got a firm editorial wall when you're relying on donations?
Very, very important for the community to understand, and I think that, and to be educated really about what it means to be an independent newsroom. What does that really mean? Well, that means, and what do we mean when we say without fear of favor? It means that we are disinterested. We're not beholden to anybody. The wall between the newsroom and advertisers in a for-profit business is there. And there are always attempts to breach it. And I think there will be attempts to breach the wall in a nonprofit. But that's up to the newsroom and to Steve and our board to keep that wall in place. And I think that the more we explain it and explain why and how important it is for us to be a neutral arbiter and not to be doing any favors and not to be afraid of offending any particular group, including our own board members, I think the more they respect what we're doing and the more they understand what it means to be an independent organization. And I think we've made it very clear. We've made it very clear on our website. We've made it very clear in every conversation that we have with funders and potential funders. And I think Steve's right. I think that they understand it, but we need to be vigilant all the time, obviously, and just be prepared to stand our ground and explain why there is this firewall between money and content.
Do you think your model, nonprofit, digital, deep in certain kinds of stories, community supported, is that the future of local journalism? And are you optimistic about the future of local journalism, the two of you?
Well, I could make a comment on that. I spent some time after I retired early from the Globe doing a little teaching at Yale's Business School on how to pay for journalism in a digital future. And I do think the answer is to some degree size dependent. The bigger places, particularly if they're technically sophisticated, can have data sets big enough to do very sophisticated predictive analytics, and that's different than clickbait. But at any rate, they can figure out ways to make real money in a digital environment. Very small places, if you were simply trying to survive on pure advertising, it's very hard to beat out the big guns of Google and Facebook and others for very efficient ways of advertising. And paywalls leave out some of the community who can't afford it. So I definitely feel at the lower level that the nonprofit pure 501c3 public charity approach is perhaps the best approach. But it varies by size, and places the size, let's say, of Boston or Philadelphia are probably somewhere in the middle. But for us and our size, our founders thought very long and hard about several different models, including a public benefit corporation, and came to the conclusion that this was the right way to do it. And I wouldn't have joined if I didn't agree with that. I think it is for our size. And so far, we're off to a good start, but we can't sit on our laurels. We've still got to raise money, and that will happen more easily with great content.
Bobby, as we close here.
I would just add that.
Go ahead.
I think anybody who thinks that there's an answer to this question isn't being completely honest. I think this is an adventure. I think it's an experiment. I think that things in the media world are changing so quickly. I don't know what the landscape's going to be a few years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I don't know how we will have to evolve and adapt. I just know that change is inevitable. It's breathtaking. It's speeding up. We're trying this. We're very optimistic. We're very committed to it. We think it can work, but we've got to constantly be ready to shift as needs require us to. And, I think there are all kinds of things that are going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years that we can't even imagine in terms of communications.
So Bobby, I'm going to end with you, and I'm going to read you a bit of a poem written by Matt DeMello. He grew up in New Bedford, wrote the poem to commemorate the light's founding. The poem's called "For Every Lighthouse There Is a Watchman." The snow has begun to melt. I can see the sand dunes at last. Summer is almost here, and you, dear lighthouse, is all I need to see what I have written. Here in the lantern room where I make it happen, on paper, with a number 2 pencil, I can hear the sound of late-night ideas. I can see the boats asleep in the water. Bobby, is the lantern room the newsroom, and are you the watchman?
Well, I don't know if I'm the watchman. I think the newsroom is the lantern, and I think that our mission is to illuminate our community and look at it in its totality. And especially to shine a light where it's most needed.
That was Barbara Rossner, founding editor of the New Bedford Light, and Stephen Taylor, its publisher. For more of their in-depth reporting on New Bedford, you can visit their website, newbedfordlight.org.